Blog Talk Radio. Hello and welcome to the November 27th edition of Don't Let It Go Unheard, the podcast devoted to the discussion of news and politics from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy, Objectivism. I'm your host, Amy Peikoff, and here are the topics that I have planned today. First, from the makers of Occupy Wall Street, we get Occupy Black Friday. We'll discuss what it was and why it was such a failure. Second, David Horowitz's Restoration Weekend. That was the reason that we abandoned you last week and didn't have a podcast. Was it worth it? Third, the GOP foreign policy debate. Did we learn anything new in this latest in the seemingly endless series of debates? Yes, I think we learned a little bit, and I'll share some of my views, and I hope to hear yours. And then finally, we have the end of the NBA lockout as a case study in the power of unions to generally make a mess of stuff that we like. We'll talk about that, maybe a little bit more if we have some time. Before we dive in here, we have some logistics. There are two ways for those of you who are attending live to interact with me. First, you can call in, and the phone number is 760-888-5817. Again, that's 760-888-5817. The other way is the chat room, and I see we've got some users already there in the chat room. Nobody's actually typing anything yet, but some people are hovering there. Feel free to type in little comments or questions, etc. Sometimes I see the chat kind of has people talking with themselves and not necessarily to me, but I look for comments and questions in that place as well. And so, without further ado, if you're ready, let's go ahead and start in. Who actually went out and shopped during Black Friday? Anybody actually go out and do that and brave the crowds? Anybody in the chat room have any stories to tell? I don't see anybody talking there in the chat room about this. But, you know, there's a tradition every Friday after Thanksgiving, people go out and they try to take advantage of all sorts of crazy sales that the retailers set up. And usually they'll have some ridiculous deal on the latest electronics, the hottest video game, whatever the Christmas gift is that your kids are whining about, they're going to have a great deal on it, but they're going to have only a limited quantity. So people camp out all night in lines and they fight with each other. Sometimes they fight physically with each other. It can get really nasty. So Occupy Wall Street, being the helpful people that they are, decided that they would go ahead and add to this wonderful institution of American life. And they would go ahead and have something called Occupy Black Friday. What were they going to do exactly? Well, sometimes they actually are going to go to these retail locations. That's what they plan to do, go to some of these retail locations and demonstrate there. Now, of course, that's not very helpful. Why? Because you're just adding to the crowds of the normal Black Friday shopping spree. Other things that they plan to do, though, is try to actually boycott, not shop at certain businesses. So this is where Occupy engages in their class warfare strategy. So they say, okay, well, it's not that we want you to boycott everybody, right? We don't want you to boycott the so-called small businesses or hardworking people. They say that we make a distinction between the businesses that are in the pockets of Wall Street and the businesses that serve our local communities. They say we are not anti-capitalist, just anti-crapitalist. And then they give you this short list of the publicly traded large businesses that you should boycott. And this included Abercrombie & Fitch, Amazon.com, AT&T Wireless, Burlington Coat Factory, Dick's Sporting Goods, Dollar Tree, Home Depot, Neiman Marcus, Office Max, Toys R Us, Verizon Wireless, and then Walmart. So all of these were supposed to be boycotted. Of course, from what I understood about Black Friday, the incidents that were reported disproportionately occurred at Walmart stores and didn't necessarily have to do anything with, you know, Occupy Black Friday. They just happened to happen there. So people had heard maybe about the woman who pepper sprayed fellow customers in order to get at some video game or whatever it was. That happened at Walmart. I'm not sure if the one thing that I heard about a man, he actually died while shopping somewhere. I think he was at Target. I don't think he was at Walmart. You know, he died. He collapsed while he was shopping. It wasn't anything to do with anybody doing something bad to him that made him die. It would have happened, you know, whatever he was doing that day, I guess. He dropped dead from a heart attack or something. And he collapses on the floor, and people just blithely walk over him and continue with their shopping, right? But other things that happen at Walmart, I think in a
shop
parking
till
lot.
You drop.
Shop till you drop. That's terrible, Bosch.
It is.
That's really bad.
I don't know about the story, sorry.
Yeah, but you know, here's the Occupy people, the people who say, you know, we've got these problems in our country. We want, for instance, the government to increase its largesse and cover our student loans because we got our expensive college educations and now we can't get jobs. Right. You know, and it's not that we're against success. It's just that we think that there's evil people on Wall Street or that the big corporations are the problem. So they're, you know, this is what they're going to do. Their latest thing. You know, they did have a day, I think a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, where they said, hey, we want you to switch your bank, you know, get all your money out of the big banks and go to a small credit union. And that's really going to show them, you know, stick it to them. And so this is just the latest iteration of that. We're going to go ahead and stick it to them. And to me, when I saw this, I said, okay, they thought you were going to, you know, basically they think they're in favor of success or improvement of our country. But when you look at this, you say these people, they have no pretense at all. They are against success of any kind. And, you know, I've been thinking about this more because even the Tea Party emails that I got this past weekend, you know, the Tea Party wants to react and encourage
boycott.
People to shop. Yeah, boycott, right? I got an email from Grass Fire Nation. Somehow I got on their email list. And they declared something called Small Business Saturday. And this was an opportunity for you to step away from the big box stores and support America's small businesses. This is Tea Party, okay? Now, this particular group, Grass Fire Nation, I get...
Small tea?
Yes, I don't know. I get a updates from them periodically, and a lot of them are very pro Ron Paul. Mm. And we've heard Ron Paul discuss the problems with big corporations. I don't have a problem with people singling out crony capitalism as a problem, but what some of these Tea Party members do, including Ron Paul at times at least, I think most of the time, and some of the Ron Paul supporters, they paint corporations with a broad brush. Big corporation equals bad, you know, automatically. And Huntsman, right? Huntsman's a GOP candidate. I remember there was a debate, not this week's debate, but some prior debate, and he was talking about certain banks or certain corporations, and he's saying, well, maybe if they're too big to fail, maybe they're too big.
Hmm.
And so his solution wasn't, oh, well, we'll...
That was Perry.
No, it was,
okay.
it was Huntsman. I mean, Perry might have said something similar, but I remember in particular
right.
Huntsman saying, maybe if they're too big to fail, they're too big. And then Huntsman is the only one that I remember proposing the following. He didn't say, oh, let's not bail them out, you know, a la crony capitalism, or, you know, let's not give them favorable regulatory reprieves or any of these things. Huntsman said, we should right-size them.
Right-size them.
Right-size them.
Like
so
we have to right-size government?
If they're too big to fail, they're too big, right? And so, therefore, the solution is not, let's just go ahead and let them fail.
She said the same thing about government, right? Big government?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that would be nice, too. Although, we don't want our federal government to fail, right? Our federal government has a purpose that we very much need
them.
It for.
He says, yeah, we need them, but we have to right-size them.
Yeah, we're going to right-size the corporations. So, it's basically, those of you who know Atlas Shrugged, there's a certain part of Atlas Shrugged where the government is calling for companies to sell off parts of their assets or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the kind of thing that Huntsman, a GOP candidate, is calling for. I mean, at least implicitly, he says right-sizing. You know, he gets his 30-second soundbite.
Can you call him by his real name, please?
Which?
Putzman.
I forgot. It's been 2 weeks. I forgot
That's
that was the appropriate nickname for him. But the thing with him is that he'll give these preambles.
Oh,
so he doesn't even get the typical 30-second substantive soundbite that he wastes 15 seconds saying, you know, this great nation of ours is in a time
It'll
of crisis.
Bring a light to the world.
And, you know, I can be Huntsman just by spouting off this stuff. But, you know, he finally gets to the substance of his point, and then he says right sizing. He doesn't tell you what he means. But you know what they mean. They mean having government forcibly come in and tell you you have to, you know, reduce the size of your company. These people do not draw a line between the crony capitalism. I mean, they just assume that all the big corporations are on the government teat, so to speak, that I've, you know, heard people talk about. And it's just not true. And so this idea that you are going to be good if you shop small businesses or if you shop local, you know, if you shop patriotic, I've even heard that they, you know, buy our best patriotic products up
buy
to
American.
61% off, you know,
no matter what,
buy
even
American,
if even if it's mediocre.
You know, there was an essay that came out, and I'm not sure if it was
Buy American
is un-American. It is, you know, this is produced by the Ayn Rand Institute, Leonard Peikoff. And it is un-American. For us in a free country, we should buy according to our wishes. And, yeah, we may want to decide as a reaction to Occupy Black Friday that we want to go out and buy some more just to show them something, but we shouldn't be told,
Limited.
Buy this way, buy with small businesses, do this. Now, suppose you wanted via your purchasing with your money, you know, purchasing with your non-tax dollars, the money you actually get to keep. Suppose you wanted to make a statement, you wanted to help the economy by purchasing. Could you do it by putting money into small businesses? And I was thinking about this, right? And I was thinking again about this issue. And I've talked about it a little bit, I think, in connection with the Huntsman comment. There's a reason that we have so many big, big businesses and that small businesses are somewhat of an endangered species. And it comes down to regulation. And I remember saying this some few weeks ago on the show when Huntsman talked about right-sizing these big companies. I said, why don't you pull out the regulations that create such an expensive regulatory burden that the small businesses can't survive? And then you'll see a higher proportion of small businesses actually survive, I think. Oh, we do. We have a call. Somebody wants to chime in here. Let me finish my point, and then we're going to take a call. So my point is, let's pull out the regulatory burden. We'll see a higher proportion of these small businesses survive, and then we won't have this problem of too big or too big to fail. It's going to take care of itself via the free market. That's what I think is the big issue. So let me go ahead and take a call here. Hi, you're on the show.
Mm-hmm.
I think you need to turn your speaker volume down.
Hello?
Okay, I'm hearing only myself now, so I'm going to have to go ahead and mute. Sorry about that. If you want to try and call back again and let me know in the chat room that you're there and that you fixed the feedback problem, we'll go ahead and unmute you and have you on the show. That would be great. So, you know, here, if Occupy Black Friday wants to make some sort of statement and they have certain businesses that they don't want to patronize, of course, they have every right in the world to do that. It's a free country. At least right now, it's still semi-free. You can choose to spend your money where you wish in order to make certain types of statements. You can go on the internet and ask everybody else to follow you and boycott Amazon or whoever else that you think is bad. And this is the same as George Lucas, right? We always talk about George Lucas has been destroying his great films by endlessly
adding,
coming out with these special versions and revised versions, right?
Yeah. Making them worse and worse. And people say, you know, their argument is, well, he has every right. Of course he does.
Yeah.
He has every right to drive his car off a cliff, and as long as he doesn't hurt anyone, yeah, he has a right to do that. He owns it. It's his property. But
That doesn't mean it's a good thing to do. And I think that Occupy Black Friday lost itself some credibility because its idea was that it, you know, it at least was on the side of America, that it wanted America to succeed, it wanted to make improvements, and if all they're trying to do is destroy businesses and the economy, I mean, this is the one day a year where you've got all these businesses, they call it Black Friday because they're going to go from the red into the black, right? They're finally going to be profitable because of all the shopping that people are going to do.
Make
and these people want to mess it up because I really think they're showing themselves to be in favor of destruction for the sake of destruction. Nihilists above all. Then the other thing is that they're making it more dangerous for their fellow shoppers, people who are the bargain hunters. And these are the 99%, right? So, I mean, supposedly they're in favor of the 99%. They think that they are spokespeople for the 99%. And it's the 99% who has to go out and shop at Walmart and Target and everything else. So why in the world, basically, would they want to go ahead and cause more additional damage to these people or pose more of a danger to these people? Like I said, at a number of places, the Occupy people were out there picketing. And if they were doing that, that they were basically, you know, glomming up the traffic, creating more stress for people, shoppers that get more stressed are more likely to get involved in these altercations, et cetera. So, yeah, they've got a right to do it technically, but that's really not the issue. Just as George Lucas has a right to screw up his films, they have a right to lose their credibility. They have a right to hurt the 99%, the very people whom they're supposedly spokespeople for. Similarly, Tea Party members, right? This boycott thing that they're going to go out and they're really going to help the economy. I saw one article where it was asserted that if you do this buy local thing, that by doing that, you're actually creating less money for people to spend in your localities. Now, how the mechanism is exactly that they propose that I don't know. But let me give you a hypothesis here, which is that if you want to help the economy, unfortunately, I think that right now the place to spend is more with the big business, not the small business, if you value investment in creating future jobs, et cetera. So here's why. I think right now, like I said, there's a regulatory burden that is favoring the big businesses because they have economies of scale that allow them to absorb the regulatory burden and still remain profitable. Yes, there are a number of small businesses that are struggling, that are hanging in there. They're able to survive in this economy. But I'm not so sure that those businesses are thriving to the extent of making a profit that could be reinvested in the economy. Now, it's true that even a number of big businesses are saying, forget that, we're not hiring anybody, we're not investing until this Obama guy is out of there. You know, I don't know that even the next Republican is going to be that much better than Obama anyway, but they're, you know, they are putting a hold on these activities. But I think the entities that are more likely to have extra money to invest in our economy and to grow our economy and to help us out of this recession are not the small businesses, unfortunately. They are the big businesses. And I'm not saying that's good. It's really nice to be able to go into a small business, talk to a real person who actually knows what he's talking about. I mean, take stereos, for example. You go into a small specialty stereo store, and you can actually learn about the features of the equipment, you know. Say you want to go buy a stereo or a new TV or something, and you go to a big box store like a Best Buy, and you try to ask one of the employees about the features. You might get lucky. They might have a minimum wage or, you know, close to that employee who actually knows something, but they don't pay their employees for knowledge there. So I think it would be much better if we did have that option more frequently to go to a small business that was doing well. But I think this idea of, oh, well, let's patronize the small businesses. Right now, without lifting that regulatory burden, I think what you'd be doing is you'd be keeping alive people who prefer to own their own business and live that lifestyle. So you're supporting them, and that's not bad. But if your idea is, I want to spend my money and support the economy, I don't know that that's what you're doing, because I don't know that you're contributing to an entity that's going to create profits to the extent of being able to reinvest. So that's kind of my pet theory about this. And shame on someone like Huntsman who says, oh, the solution is we're going to right-size the companies. That's just adding another layer of regulation on top of all the regulations that create the problems in the first place. But that's just very
government.
That's very typical of these politicians. Oh, you know, there ought to be a law, right? That's the solution of all politicians. Now, in terms of my audience here online, I've got DB saying no shopping for me. Black Friday crowds scare me. Yeah, I don't go out on Black Friday. Now, I like having the internet to be able to take advantage of some Black Friday deals from the comfort of my own home.
Yeah.
Michael here says nope, I hid. And what will we have?
They quoted me.
Oh, about the shop till you drop. Yeah, they like your little joke there. Now, I don't know if our person who was on hold actually wanted to talk or maybe was listening by that way. So I think we're not going to discuss with him. So do you think I've covered this topic to death or what, Bush?
Yeah.
Yeah?
You've occupied it pretty well.
I've occupied this topic. That's the other thing is these occupy people. It just makes you use the word occupy for everything. It is kind of catchy. It's kind of a funny way, you know, to talk about things. But
think about what they're saying also by that name, occupy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're occupying someone else's territory, someone else's business, someone else's street, someone else's. I mean, they're not starting anything.
Yeah, and
they're coming second for sloppy seconds. You know, coming wherever they want to take over.
Well, and they're proud of it too.
Real
you know,
proud of it.
This is a badge that they wear that they're occupying.
They're not creating anything, zero. They're just getting in the way.
Yeah.
A progress.
Well, and that's what they tried to do. Now, the question is, did they succeed?
Yeah. Did they?
Did they succeed? And actually, no.
Yeah.
They did not. Black Friday sales, CNBC.com tells us, the sales rose 6.6%.
Excellent.
It was a record $11.4 billion spent on Black Friday, which is typically the busiest shopping day of the year for Americans, say, while traffic at stores rose 5.1%. Now, why is this? Probably because a lot of people waited until these deals came around to shop. Why?
Because
you know, again, okay, Occupy people, the 99% needs these deals to survive, and you just wanted to get in the way.
Yep.
You're bad people. The day sales growth, they say on the CNBC article, is the strongest percentage gain since 2007, when sales rose 8.3% on the day after Thanksgiving. As usual, retailers use deep discounts on popular items such as toys and televisions to lure shoppers as the holiday shopping season began. Some started their sales as early as Thanksgiving night to get a jump on their rivals. And apparently this is one of the things that the Occupy people were upset about, is that they were starting their sales at midnight.
Technically on that day.
Yeah.
And to the minute, yeah.
Yeah, to the minute. So they start. Some of them started apparently even before midnight at 10 p.m. That's what I heard, although I didn't hear of a single example of a store that did open then. Yeah. But they opened at midnight. Occupy people are all upset because this is cutting into the workers' Thanksgiving dinners. How about giving people a lucrative job so that they can actually feed their families? But no, you know, Occupy people wouldn't want that. And certainly they wouldn't want to actually work one of those jobs themselves. They'd rather sit there and protest, I guess. They're estimating that sales for all of November and December will rise about 3 to 3.3%. Whether this is just a temporary blip, whether this just shows that people basically waited until they could get a deal, or they, you know, put off all their shopping all year until they had to buy presents for other people. They didn't indulge for themselves. I'd like to see some more detailed stats. But it does seem that the Occupy Black Friday effort did fail.
Excellent.
And I was glad to see it. And as I said, I think it failed also in terms of them sustaining their public image as any sort of friend of success for anybody, or even a friend of the 99%, because they're preventing their fellow 99%, you know, percenters.
Or if they could be effective at all, even negatively. Yeah. They weren't able to.
No.
You know, I tweeted, I said, you know, 99% of them are occupiers on Black Friday, and 1% of them are the occupiers, and they couldn't get it done, which is great. They just wanted to get in the way.
That's make a statement, call attention to themselves. Now, what was
drama
your
queens.
The other one you had was Occupy Black Friday, Occupy Jail.
Occupy jail cells. No, because what would they do? Would they stop people from shopping physically? You know, if they did that, they're asking for trouble.
Yeah.
Physical trouble.
Yeah, apparently they haven't actually physically obstructed, but like I said, you go to these places and it's just too stressful. I mean, you know, here people
in
saying
general, it is, right.
They hid, you know, they don't want to go out in the
crowd. I don't remember last time if I ever went Black Friday shopping. I don't even know.
Yeah.
I don't.
No. I don't want to do it. And
but
and what you
do.
Do is you add to their stress. You just add to their stress by being there, by making your stupid statement. So that's Occupy. Next topic. Are you ready? So last weekend we bailed on you and attended David Horowitz's restoration weekend. It was torture, but we had to do it. We had to go to Florida, Palm Beach.
Gorgeous.
Gorgeous weather, wind, 80 degrees.
The breeze, beautiful,
yeah.
Gorgeous, right on the ocean.
Yeah, just it was just terrible. We really had to sacrifice and everything.
That's right.
Now, the question is, was it worth it? Did we gain anything that we can communicate to people from
Absolutely.
Restoration Weekend?
Yeah.
Now, highlight for you, Bosch, was, of course...
Well, the highlight was when we got there, we heard there was going to be a short notice panel between Robert Spencer, head of Jihad Watch, and Andrew C. McCarthy, who writes for National Review. He also put away the blind sheikh in the 90s. They've been having an ongoing debate about is it Islam or Islamism? That's a problem. That's an enemy's ideology.
What terminology
exactly.
Do you use? Do you use Islam or do you use Islamism or some other modified
and
term?
McCarthy has been fluctuating back and forth between a few different terms, Islam itself, Islamism to many different terms, and Robert is always consistent, but that the problem is Islam, as is my position. So I was excited about that, and hours before the actual debate, I was invited to be on it as a panel member, which was great. After someone else was invited, and I was there to back up Robert, to be he's one of the only guys who I'd be Robin to his Batman. And it was great. I had an opportunity to spend about 10 minutes, a few hours before we found out. So I tried to organize my thoughts. Amy helped me get it together, make an outline, just get the main points across. And I think it came off very well.
Yeah, they gave you 10 minutes to speak.
So
this whole panel will be available. It was videotaped.
Yeah.
It should be available online at some point. We'll go ahead and put it up there. But it was very interesting to have this discussion. So you had Karen Lugo, who's from the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence out of Claremont.
She was the moderator.
She was the moderator. And then Robert Spencer from Jihad Watch, Andrew McCarthy.
Andrew C. McCarthy.
Andrew C. McCarthy. Yeah, because we don't want to confuse him with
the
actor, right?
I think that's why those are Andrew C. McCarthy.
And then, of course,
Baroness.
Baroness Caroline Cox,
who does a lot of excellent work.
A lot of excellent work in England, basically fighting the progress of Sharia in her country and fighting the effects of Islam, especially as it impacts women living in Britain.
Right.
She had some real horror stories.
Horror stories, but it was great, great being there with these great people, fighting a great fight against this enemy, especially, to support Robert Spencer in the position that I share with him, that the enemy is Islam. Every other name is concocted and it's alien to the enemy itself. So it's great.
Now, the result, this particular topic, this terminology topic, is one that I've talked about with Bosch for years now, a few years. And at first, I think I was more sympathetic to some of the arguments that people use to, say that you have to be objective to your audience who doesn't understand the nature of Islam and other types of arguments. And the result of talking with Bosch over these years and then culminating in the discussion that people had this weekend was a post that I put on my blog at don'tletitgo.com. It's called Islam by Any Other Name. And there I lay out the issue and kind of where my thinking is on it at this point. And I lay out questions and have people go ahead and contribute and discuss. And there is a huge, lengthy discussion going on there on
good,
the blog.
Good, bad, ugly, good, some yeah. real terrible comments, but there, some great ones too.
Yeah, so it's all over the map. What I do in essence is I lay out, first of all, my view that it is Islam itself that is the ideology, that we should be naming it as Islam. That is the enemy's ideology. The enemy that is fighting us now, that has declared war on us, even if we haven't declared war on it. Yes, yeah. Ron Paul, I agree. We haven't declared war. It is Islam. That is their ideology. Nonetheless, I say you have to have some sort of terminology to distinguish people who are trying to kill you from those people who think that they are Muslims or they think that they're following Islam, but they're not doing these things. They don't pose a risk to you, right? I mean, in justice, you have to have some sort of a concept or terminology
to say
these are the ones that are trying to kill you and these are the ones who are
trying to
kill you.
I think the terms exist. Jihadists, the stealth jihadists, the consistent practitioners of Islam. But, I mean, it's an ongoing debate.
Yeah.
And it's worth having. And, Amy, you use, well, you're leaning towards right now using a certain term for that.
Yeah, well.
You favor a certain term.
Well, I have a favorite certain term. I actually like, in terms of referring to the people, the term Islamist. But Bosch disagrees with that.
And, I don't like the term.
And Robert Spencer also disagrees with using the term Islamist to refer to the people, because he thinks that that term has been polluted out in the culture, discussions that have been going on out in the culture. But, I'm not necessarily wedded to that term. I have a slight preference for naming and dividing the groups of people by naming the group that wants to kill us something, right?
You know what?
I want to put a name to the people who want to kill us. Now, those people aren't all necessarily what we think of as jihadists. They're all not going to get on a plane and fly it into a building tomorrow. Some of them are what, you said, stealth jihadists.
Yeah. They're trying to Islamize the West, trying to push Islam onto us by any means necessary.
Some of them are active, but they're not necessarily that active.
Yeah, I mean, look,
faithful,
faithless Muslims, active, passive, I mean, it's all, but, I mean, there's one term that I do use at times. I'm always reluctant to use any old term besides Islam, but I just finished writing a piece, and it should be up in a few days, hopefully. But it's about those who are part of an organized effort to spread Islam. You know, I sometimes refer to this collective effort by Muslims as "quote unquote" organized Islam. Again, I'm reluctant to use it, but this is my distinction. No matter the means involved, Muslims working towards a more Islamic world want the same things the jihadists want.
More slowly when you're reading that.
Okay, I'm sorry. I just wanted to, this organized effort includes mosques, Muslim organizations, Muslim individuals writing books, blog posts, etc. And, one thing about them, they all invariably engage in anti-Western, anti-Israeli propaganda at the very least. I forget about the outright threats towards infidels.
Right. So then the question is, what terminology do you think is best? I've heard Islamic fundamentalist, right?
There's Sam Harris said something about that. He goes...
Or fundamentalist Muslims.
The problem with fundamentalist Muslims is the fundamentals of Islam. That's pretty good.
Right.
That's very well put.
But the issue is that you do not want to whitewash the nature of Islam.
No.
Via your choice of terminology.
In order to, to acknowledge the existence of Muslims who are now trying to kill us.
Right. So if you talk about, for instance, radical Islam.
I hate that.
Then you are implying that there is a non-radical Islam.
Political Islam, militant Islam, those are redundant terms.
Totalitarian Islam.
It is.
Right?
Absolutely, because Islam by nature is totalitarian. It is political. It is militant.
Well, and then there's even this other term that Robert Spencer has used at times, Islamic supremacist.
Yeah. I'm not crazy about it, but I don't mind it as much. I mean, maybe it's because Robert, one thing about him, he always uses Islam. So if he wants to use a signifier of some sort to amplify something, I'll give it to him because he's always consistent with those who use different terms never use the word Islam.
Right.
They never do.
Yeah. So I think Islamist, in my mind, would mean the same thing as what Spencer means by Islamic supremacist.
I call these terms Islamicist, as in their assistants to Islam, their Islam assistants, but anyway.
Right.
Because they're covering up Islam.
Right. But for me, I want to have a term that does justice to the groups of people, because it is not the case that all these Muslims want to get us, right?
No.
I have people who have posted on my blog that have said all Muslims are our enemies. And that nobody thinks
there
all
are many non-Muslim Muslims out there. I call them, in my talk, I refer to them as post-Islamic Muslims, especially those living in the West.
Some people have used the term Muslims in name only.
Yeah,
right?
Minos. Muslims in name only, which is true. I personally, I know enough. I know many non-Muslim Muslims. I have family members who are quote unquote non-Muslim Muslims. Well, they don't call themselves that. They consider themselves Muslim.
Right.
But they have no animosity towards infidels.
Now, the problem for me with putting the name on the non-enemy group of Muslims, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the ones who don't want to kill us.
Right.
Is that
right.
There is nothing by way of an organized belief system
right.
that is held in common by these people,
exactly.
right? You've got the true adherents to Islam,
yep,
the ones who are going to go ahead and take everything literally, like the Quran says you should,
yep,
and kill the infidel wherever you find them, etc., those people you can actually group according, yep, to a name that, you know, signifies the fact that they all hold an ideology consistently and they plan to do something with it. But if you try to name this non-group, you're naming them according to attributes that they don't have.
It's defining
via a negative, which I think you try to always avoid if you can. I don't necessarily have a problem with using terms like Muslim in name only, or, you know, in the past, sure, we talk about Republicans in name only, the rhinos. Right?
Because they exist. It's a true identification. But also, one thing, the problem with that also is when people are trying to cite, trying to distinguish between Muslims who don't want to kill us and those who do, and the ideology, sometimes they use every other term besides Islam, classical Islam, virulent Islam, this Islam, and they give the term Islam to those who are not really practitioners of Islam. So they will use the term Islam, but only for those who are not trying to kill us, which is, you know,
right,
it gives a break to Islam again. It exonerates Islam. And Islam should be back on the hook of where it belongs.
Now, I have collected, because I've received, like I said, on my blog, and then also I got a very detailed email response, I guess, from someone who didn't want to post on my blog. I haven't had a chance to go entirely through it, but it's very thoughtful. And part of it was saying, you know, look, and people always say this, there's these other religions.
Mm-hmm.
In their religious texts, there's some violence, or there's condoning violence, or maybe there's calling for violence. I'm not aware of calls for violence to the extent as there is in the Quran. So what is it, you know, why is Islam so different? Now, there's a couple different things to say. One is that Islam as an ideology completely accepted, you know, from beginning to end, is actually motivating a huge significant chunk of people in the world today, and therefore posing a danger to us. Now, if we were living in the age of the Spanish Inquisition, we'd say the same thing about Catholicism. But here we're talking about what ideology is motivating a bunch of people today to try to kill us. So there's that issue. But then there's a number of things about Islam that make it distinctive. And I wrote a list here, this is just off the top of my head. I can't quote chapter and verse the way that Robert Spencer can.
Yeah.
But if you read the Quran and you read all the commentary, he's got this blogging the Quran commentary on Jihad Watch that you can read. And he ties the Quran to the various chapters of the Hadith. He talks about how various respected scholars within Islam interpret all the passages and such. So this is what you can learn about Islam and what makes it distinctive and what makes it unlikely to be truly moderated or reformed in the way that some people are hoping. So
Islam in a sense already had its reformation, Wahhabism, they call it, quote unquote, Wahhabism. It went back to the texts, went back to the original source, Muhammad, the Sirah, the biography of Muhammad, the Hadith, the Quran.
So the Quran is, according to itself, it's the revealed, unaltered word of Allah. From beginning to end, it's not to be questioned by Muslims. It says that a couple of places in the Quran. There is the doctrine of abrogation, which says that the earlier peaceful passages in the Quran are superseded by the ones that come chronologically later, like the verse of the
sword. And quote-unquote modern Muslims will never mention that. They will only go back and cite those allegedly peaceful ones.
And the doctrine of abrogation, it's mentioned in the Quran itself where it says, you know, when I reveal things later, they are better, you know, something of that sort.
Because he had mediocre, revelations earlier. I mean, that's what he's admitting, Allah.
Basically. It says in the Quran that you should follow Muhammad as an example for your own conduct.
He's referred to in Arabic, the Insana al-Kamil, which I pronounce insane camel.
Right.
But it's true. He is considered the personification of Islam, to be copied by all humanity, not just Muslims.
And then all over the Quran, it says that Jews are bad.
Yeah.
And
they're the descendants of apes and pigs.
Yeah. And you can do bad things to them.
Yeah.
There's stories
nothing that protects
about
them.
You know, Muhammad doing bad things to them that are referred to in the Quran. It says, of course, you can beat your wife. It tells you do not be friends with any non-Muslims.
Right.
And in fact, there has been some misinterpretation about certain passages of the Quran. You know, it says use Abraham as an example for something. And the thing that they really want you in the Quran to use in Abraham as an example for is the fact that he would not be friends with or have relations with family members who were non-Muslims.
Right.
He rejected them completely.
Because in Islam, the conceit is that all former prophets, Moses and Jesus, they were all Muslims.
And then there's the doctrine of taqiyya, which says that you can use
lying,
dishonesty as a method for spreading the religion. Of course, there's the passage that says, kill the infidel wherever you find him. Is it
a number of passages?
Chapter 9, verse 29.
In their particular, it is spread throughout the Quran. But yeah, there's the verse of the sword, and it's considered the second to last or the last chapter in the Quran, meaning the final word is all out war for all time until man is submitted.
Right.
And one thing also about some Muslims, some I guess you could refer to some of them as the non-submitted Muslims, you know, submitted Muslims and whatever. I mean, if we're going to get into this name game playing,
right,
we're going to follow it.
And then, of course, there's all the stuff in the Quran that is done for the convenience of Muhammad, some of which has had terrible results. So not just stuff that you would, you know, say he's a terrible person during his lifetime, but for instance, because he didn't want his wife to be accused of adultery or to have any charge of adultery for his wife stick, he made the requirement, conveniently got a revelation, that you had to have four witnesses to prove adultery. So that every time a woman wants to allege that she was raped, if she doesn't produce four witnesses, then she has in effect admitted that she committed adultery, and she can't pin. I mean, when are you going to have four witnesses?
It's open season for rape for the last 1,000 years in Islam because of that, for his cover-up. Right. Also, another thing, he married Aisha, his one of his favorite wife, quote unquote, when she was 6. He had sex with her when she was 9, and that fact led the Ayatollah Khomeini, in I guess in the '80s in Iran, to make the marriage age up to 9. You know, that's what he based it on.
Right. Yeah. So, for the particular things that I wanted to talk about in terms of the likelihood of Islam being moderated in some sort of systematic way that would have some staying power. When they say, look, this is the unaltered revealed word of Allah, not to be questioned by any Muslims. There's the doctrine of abrogation, so that you say that these later violent passages are supposed to, you know, go ahead and supersede the earlier peaceful ones. You're supposed to follow Muhammad as an example for your own conduct, and Muhammad's exploits are well known, or at least, you know, whether all of these are the exploits of one single person called Muhammad or not, it's in the lore of the religion to say that Muhammad did X, Y, and Z, and so therefore we should behave like him.
People in the 1800s, 1900s wrote books about the fact that maybe Muhammad never existed, and Robert Spencer has a new book coming out, Did Muhammad Exist? So there's this theories about that, but the fact is Osama bin Laden, that whole gang, all the consistent practitioners of Islam, believe he did exist, and they're basing their actions on that fact. So, on that, you know,
now,
theory
at
least.
Isn't it true that someone who writes a book like that is himself courting danger, so that Robert, because he's questioning the existence of Muhammad, he should...
Well, it's like that question you asked him in your interview.
Right.
You know, did Muhammad even believe in God?
Oh, right. Yeah, sure.
And he probably was a atheist con man. You know,
right.
He wanted secular power. He wanted power on earth in the here and now. And he told those guys, yeah, you'll get it after. I got it now, but you'll get it after. Just do what I say.
Now let's see what we've got going on here in the chat room.
Michael says, it's
here's
pretty funny.
Michael, he says,
you
I say.
I'm not going to say, but I'll say it.
What are you going to say? Go ahead.
Michael says, I say Islam is at war with Western civilization. Muslims are people who practice Islam. 1.5 billion people today call themselves Muslims, but not all are threats to us. I call the peaceful ones hams, half-assed Muslims. Lots of hams out there. And he goes, seriously, I define a Muslim a threat to us as someone who takes the Quran seriously, right? Someone who takes it literally and actively promotes Sharia, which I hold to be utterly incompatible with Constitution. Yes.
Right.
It's anti-individual rights, anti-freedom.
But everyone appreciates the problem, right, that we've got to have a term that does justice to the groups of people, because you can't lump all Muslims into the same category.
You can,
but
also one thing. You mentioned something in the panel. You said it's not like we're stopping Muslims from coming out against these people and criticizing, you know.
Right.
They have been in on it in that sense by their silence. You know, so they have sided with the enemy by their silence, and which is terrible for them as human beings. So that's what I mean. I don't know.
No, it's not that the silent Muslims who just sit by, but they don't actually do anything actively to try to hurt us. It's not that they're great, but
absolutely
it's that
not.
We will treat them differently. And so we need to separate you know, the ones who are actively trying to destroy us, you know.
No,
the,
we have to. It's...
If you look at a lot of kind of just war theory texts and stuff, there was one article in particular where someone tried to define, you know, who is your enemy? Who is an enemy combatant? And it's someone who is actively engaged in an attempt to destroy you. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're engaged in a physical attempt to destroy you. There are various ways that they can actively support the movement to try and destroy you. So there's all kinds of ways they can do this. So you want a concept to say, okay, let's refer to all of those Muslims who are actively engaged in this attempt
organized
to destroy us via the domination of Islam.
Whether by propaganda, whether by, I mean, anything, every little bit.
Yeah. Now, you know, the fact that they are happen to be motivated by Islam itself doesn't mean that they're worthy of extra condemnation. It's just that their ideology calls for them to do bad things to us, right?
And they personally resist. Some of them, you know, don't like violence. They don't engage in it.
Yeah.
But that's not a Muslim. It, you know, people trust. Sometimes they take that fact and say, well, he must be practicing a different form of Islam. No, he's not practicing Islam. He has rejected it personally for personal reasons. Who knows? It's like those Muslims who help us fight jihad, the very, very, very small minority of those who actually help us. Like Andrew C. McCarthy brings up the fact that there were Muslims who helped you know, bring in the blind sheikh. His idea is that they must be practicing some form of Islam. Of course they're not. They're going against Islam, in essence. They're doing it for personal reasons, whatever, money. Maybe they have a conscience. Who knows?
Well, and one thing that we learned from Robert Spencer when we had that interview with him, if people don't know, I had a Quran reading group and that I hosted through the old platform that I used to use. And we met every week and we had read a passage, you know, chunk of the Quran. And then we also read Spencer's commentary and we discussed it. And at the second to last meeting, I believe, Robert Spencer came and took questions for an hour. And I've recorded that and I actually put it as a podcast on my blog at don'tletitgo.com. So if you search for Robert Spencer there, you'll find it. One thing that came out there that was interesting was he said that most Muslims haven't read the Quran.
Right.
They don't know what's in there.
As an example of me, I think I might be the only member of my family who actually read the Quran. They call themselves Muslims, my family. Which is telling.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So, and that's
so
why whenever I bring up jihad, they don't want to hear it.
Yeah, so it's not like they know that they're violating it, you know.
But
they
there's
might,
silence.
They
there's
might
silence.
Hear sound that's... bites. Yeah, they're silent. And that is, I mean, by their silence, they are somewhat complicit.
Yeah,
but
and,
nonetheless.
And also they give a good face to Islam. Because, well, you know, they're nice, right?
Right. Now, in terms of reasons why we would want to use a term like Islamism, or some other term to refer to the ideology. You know, one argument that we heard there was that we want to give rhetorical space to those Muslims who would be moderate. We don't want to tell them, in effect, that their ideology is as bad as it is.
In the middle of a war, you know,
right.
That's the problem. We are at war.
Right.
And we should, you know what? I mean, look, the only time that Islam could be, quote unquote, enlightened, let's say, is in a post-jihad world where the state-sponsored terrorism are defeated, where terrorist groups are, you know, disbanded because of fear, out of outright fear. And then they start saying, okay, well, those who are left, those who are, you know, they start, quote-unquote, I think, moderating themselves because they know the price that they'll pay otherwise.
Yeah,
they have to join the civilized world.
If we fought a proper war, for sure.
Yeah,
now,
we would moderate Islam just by that.
Yeah,
by a major war.
You know, again, whenever you're choosing a terminology, it should be using terminology that will help you to think about the issue accurately, so you can actually think about the facts of reality and decide what to do in the face of them. Right, that's your first concern. And then, of course, there's the concern of being able to communicate clearly to other people. So these are your legitimate concerns. You don't say, oh, well, I'm going to choose a terminology that will give so-called rhetorical space to people who I want to have be my friends, right? For some reason, we think maybe they're going
to
help us by testifying
the
against the blind sheikh.
I mean, it's basically it's trying to sacrifice the truth for a nice reason. You know, and that never works. It never does. And one thing, you want to mention the one line I said, which got a good reaction, or just let them watch?
Oh, well, the thing I was going to mention was that Robert Spencer, had a great thing to say in reaction to that issue of rhetorical space. He said, of what value is rhetorical space if it's based on a lie?
Right. Absolutely right.
Right. If you're doing something to whitewash the nature of this ideology, then I don't think that that rhetorical space is valuable at all.
No.
Now, the only other concern that I've heard, and this is something that I still need to think about, is the idea that you need to communicate with people who don't share your context of knowledge. Mm. So there's a whole lot of people who haven't studied Islam, haven't read the Quran, they don't really know. For everything that they've heard over the last 10 years, there is this peaceful version of Islam, and the hijackers at 9/11, they distorted a great religion, they hijacked a great religion, right? So this is the world that they live in, and then suddenly you come in and you tell them that Islam is the ideology that's motivating this enemy, and it's like you can't even communicate with them. That's
no.
the kind of argument that I have heard, that for the necessity of communicating to people who don't share your context of knowledge, you need to modify your terminology. And I'm still trying to decide what I think about that issue. That sort of approach has been used within objectivism. We use terms like rational self-interest or individual rights, which are redundant, yeah, technically, right? I mean, Rand holds that there are no rights that belong to groups,
right,
or to parts of individuals. Rights belong to individuals, and that's it. Similarly, self-interest. There is nothing that really is actually self-interest unless it's rationally determined. It has to be rational self-interest in order to truly be self-interest. So in a way, these terms are redundant. We use them in part to communicate with people, or perhaps even to think ourselves when we're trying to root out this context of bad philosophies, you know, altruist ideology, you know, kind of collectivist politics. 2,000 plus years, these ideas have been dominant. So perhaps you need rational self-interest. You need
to get to that point.
Individual rights to get to that point. So similarly, maybe you need supremacist Islam.
No, I mean, I think, again, in terms of Islam, we should always call it Islam. When it comes to individuals, you have the argument that maybe you can, you know, make a distinction, which is fine, because the fact is not all of them are. But again, I've written a number of times where, you know, heroes are a small minority in all cultures, even in Islam. Jihadists are Islam's heroes. They are. And so they're not going to – not every Muslim will go out there and do their Islamic duty the way they do. And you know what? Al-Qaeda can't find enough Muslims to throw their lives away for Islam. They can't. I mean, you know, even the suicide killers on 9/11, you know, we learned that only the pilots knew it was a suicide mission.
Right. The rest of them thought it was a regular hijacking.
The rest of them thought it was a regular, quote-unquote, you know – hijacking, a traditional hijacking. But yeah, so it's tough for them to find these Muslims to even throw their lives away.
But at the same time, it's even harder to find any Muslims to speak out against.
Absolutely.
It. And that's the biggest
You said
point.
One thing, you know, we know that it's a small minority who actually engage in jihad, but as you pointed out, it's also an even smaller minority who criticize them, who condemn those.
Who will openly condemn
them,
right?
Yeah, openly condemn those evil, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't met Zudi Jasser. We get the impression that he is a nice guy, but
sure,
there are just not that many like him out there.
Yeah, but he's a freak in terms of Islam. He's against jihad, he's against Sharia, so he's against Islam. Fundamentally, he is. He's born here, raised here, but he wants to cling to the idea that Islam is good, and therefore he's good. And he has to be challenged. He has to be really, really challenged.
What you would need to see is you need something that would rise to the level of an ideology that would be held by a significant number of these non-jihadists, Muslim, right? I'd want to see this, and then.
But there isn't.
But I haven't seen such a thing, and so this is.
It's not the Muslims.
Why we've got
it's not the Muslims'
issue.
Place to go against Islam.
No.
I mean, it's not. Even if they're not practicing.
Anyway, if people do want to get in on the written discussion, please go to my blog at don'tletitgo.com, and you can talk about it. We've got some comments here.
I'm gonna look out for a piece I just finished called "Who Cares About Islam?" Should be up soon. I'll let you know when. On my blogs.
Yeah. Now, we've got some comments here on the chat room. Chris says, what ultimately do we accomplish with this effort to distinguish these not actively violent Muslims? Isn't it possible that a defanging of Islam isn't possible in the way that a defanging of Christianity has occurred over time?
Probably.
Okay, well, these are two different issues, I think, Chris. So what do we accomplish? What we do accomplish is we say, okay, here's the group that we actually need to fight and take away their rights. We don't need to take away the rights of the people who are complicit only by their silence.
Yeah.
we may want to boycott them, not associate with them, right? Supposedly still a free country. You can choose that. But it's not like we're going to do anything to them at all because nothing is required. But if you have people who are actively engaged in an effort to destroy you, those are the ones that you need to go after. And so that's why you have to make sure to distinguish those groups. And my only goal, again, is to use terminology clearly so that we can distinguish the groups that need to be distinguished in order to be just, and at the same time not whitewash the nature of Islam itself. And not say things that are redundant and therefore imply that there's a couple different versions of Islam, which I haven't seen any such thing. I haven't.
Absolutely not. There are different sects of Muslims. There's no different versions of Islam.
Yeah, nothing that's essentially. Now, then the second issue that he brings up, isn't it possible a defanging of Islam isn't possible in a way that a defanging of Christianity is? Yeah. And I think that's true.
I think also the figure of Muhammad gets, that's the big.
Yeah,
that can't get over.
It's those items that I read off in my little list that I made impromptu off the cuff here. You know, that the Quran is the revealed word of Allah. The whole entire thing is not to be questioned.
The verbatim, yeah.
It's the verbatim.
You need
verbatim.
To submit to it.
Yeah, you have to submit to it entirely. You know, this doctrine of abrogation, the injunction that you should follow Muhammad as an example for your conduct, all of these things make it less likely that you could have a plausible, moderate reformation of Islam.
It's like trying to moderate evil. Yeah. I mean, Islam is evil. Most Muslims, they don't give a damn for it.
But it is true that at different times of our history, Catholicism or Christianity could be used as a motivation to carry out some horrific acts.
But also one thing. Yeah. Can they refer to the religion, like the Crusaders? Could they have actually said, I am fighting and killing in the name of Jesus Christ because I am following in his footsteps. He did the same thing. No, they can't literally do that.
Yeah.
Jihadists can. And that's why, you know, I often say, as you know, yeah, Islam is evil, but, you know, it's the average Muslim is morally superior to Muhammad, to their own religion. You know, there's a consistent practitioner, there's organized Islam. That's, you know.
Now, Michael asks, isn't it true that a great many Muslims are actually not allowed to read the Quran? Are you aware of that?
I don't know about that.
Now, I think you could be confusing that point with one that says that if they read it in a language other than Arabic, it doesn't count.
Now, but you know what, though? Whenever some Muslim brings it up, I wish I'm in a debate with a Muslim who actually tries to pull that, because I'd say, oh really? So most, you know, Muslims, I mean, they don't speak Arabic, they don't write Arabic. So you're saying that the 1.5 billion Muslims, they're actually not Muslims. So how many percentage of that? You know what I mean?
Right.
There's only, what, 200,000 Muslims? It's 500,000 Muslims. So that's BS.
And how could be said to have signed on to something that they haven't even read?
I know. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, look, you know, this one, there's a stupid show, All American Muslim, where there's a woman in there. It's one of those reality shows. And a guy converts to Islam in order to marry a daughter of the someone on the show. And he says, I didn't know it was so easy to become Muslim, because he said the Shahada, you know, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad was a messenger. Oh, I just became Muslim. I just became Muslim.
Why did you say that?
Damn.
That's terrible.
But anyway, he said that, and then someone, the Sultan Kanish, wrote, it's easy to become Muslim, but it's almost impossible to leave Islam.
Yeah, it's like
the
song Hotel California.
Right, you're brought in.
You can try to check out any time you like, but, right? We should have that music. I should have played it right now in my you know, I need to take advantage of this studio a little bit more.
Wait,
I can
Hotel
play the intro.
California.
Oh, you are bad. Okay.
Sorry, puns. I can't help it.
We've got to have some musically inclined people out there make us a Hotel California.
That's right.
Hi. So Michael says he likes Spencer's webpage. The guy seems to have more guts than most people on the subject.
He was
the thing.
Great
the thing
the
that
talk,
I like
and,
about
and,
him.
And we, you know, could I say we closed? Okay.
So
we spent some time with him after.
Yeah, we talked a bit with him. But the thing that I like about him is that he tracks all the things that happen in the world because of people who are motivated by this ideology.
Proves it day by day by day.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know he's starting to adopt sort of a joking tone half the time. He'll say misunderstanders of Islam do X, Y, and Z,
right,
because everybody always says that only the people who misunderstand
Islam. And he gets
Islam
called on it, and I never call him on it, because the fact is he's been doing this for years. He has to have some sense of humor, or else he'll go crazy.
Yeah, I asked him. I said, "Do you still enjoy what you do?" And he said, "Yes, he did." But I think he had to think about it for a second.
I think so. I mean, it's a tough daily grind.
Yeah, imagine
dealing with the scum of the earth every
single
day.
Imagine immersing yourself in this all the time.
I mean, I get sick of it.
Yeah, definitely. Now I've got Michael voting for calling all of them Muslims. He says, let the moniker wash over them all and distinguish the nonviolent ones as a secondary.
I understand that. And that's what I refer to them as well. They have the Muslims, then you have the jihadists, the outright battlers, you know, for Islam as a term to distinguish.
Yeah. Now, Chris is talking here in the chat room about the issue that I brought up, rational mm-hmm. self-interest as being redundant. He says, self-interest is a concept of the good that has been culturally criticized as being bad. Same with rights, hence the need to distinguish. But Islam is the bad. Why the need to distinguish some good distillation? So basically he's saying that we are adding the good. Okay, this could be the difference that makes the difference that Chris is stating here. Because what we're doing with rational self-interest is we're adding the modification in the direction of telling you that there's good stuff about this thing.
Whereas with Islam, you'd be adding something.
Good stuff that is really there.
Yeah.
Whereas if you are saying, well, there is this bad version of it, of Islam.
Which
right,
a lot of people do
You're
say.
Implying that there's good things about Islam that aren't really there.
Right. And,
so that could be...
And one thing, you know, anyone who uses terms other than Islam
So Chris, you need to add that to my blog at don'tletitgo.com.
Yeah,
you have to go there and post that comment because I think that could get us somewhere in terms
so
of...
So long as you consistently use the term Islam. You want to use different terms for different specific points. I'm not crazy about it, but I get a pass. Those who consistently never use Islam and always use different terms, I don't like that.
My favorite is when the same person uses five different terms.
Oh, that's the worst. Within
one
sitting.
Talk or something. Yeah.
And then you got also three debaters, and they're all talking. You got three different guys with three different terms. And the audience is sitting there like, okay, what are we talking about here?
Yeah. Now, Chris says, if Islam can't be defanged, then the attempt to distinguish the good Muslims, well, it's not fruitful. Yes, and as I said, they're not necessarily good.
They're just, they're, you know.
Where I'm sitting with it now.
Complacent Muslims.
Where I'm sitting with it now is I want to call the ideology Islam consistently. That's what I want to do. And then I want to find a term to distinguish the people because, yes, we do have to take different sorts of actions against these different groups. But I want to do this objectively and not whitewash the nature
the
of Islam
also,
at the same time.
You know, the problem with that also is we end up playing Muslim roulette. You know, we basically until a Muslim goes off, until, you know, I make a joke. I said all Muslims have Islam and jihadists have full-blown Islam.
Yeah.
But we don't know until that moment. We don't know.
Yeah.
And that's a danger because we have to recognize the fact that we have to do some racial profiling. We have to look at names at airports and whatnot and just put them aside. You know, usually young Arab males. People, you know, even if not Arabs, if they have certain names. We have to just point them out.
We've got the top of the hour here. It is 6 p.m. Pacific time, and this is Amy Peacock for it. Don't Let It Go Unheard, and we have been talking about this kind of abstract issue of Islam versus Islamism. Islam versus Islamism. Say that 12 times fast. Islamism, Islam.
Islamicism.
Yeah. Actually,
Islamicism.
Islamicism I've heard too, right? So you just add even more. Yeah.
But then again, he did say that he doesn't know squat about
Islam.
So.
Add some more syllables. And again, the concern is we want to properly identify the enemy and his ideology and distinguish those Muslims who are enemies from those who aren't and do this objectively. So that's been the concern of this. As I said, if you want to see a blog post on this issue and weigh in writing, you go to don'tletitgo.com. November 21st, I've got a post there called Islam by Any Other Name that sums up the kind of stuff that we've been talking about here. The other thing that I wanted to mention before we go on to our next topic, which is the GOP foreign policy debate. So it's not completely unrelated, but you know, it's certainly... The debate is not conducted at a high level like this of what do we call the enemy. We had a couple guys in the debate calling it radical Islam or radical Muslims, and that's about it.
I mean,
it.
At least they said it almost, you know.
Yeah.
I can't believe it's like
we're relieved when a couple candidates actually say radical Islam.
But then
Islam,
Ron Paul
right?
uses Timothy McVeigh three times as if he's
yeah.
a Muslim,
we'll get there.
Organization.
We'll get there. One more point I wanted to make. The other one, actually, some people follow the Ayn Rand bot on Twitter. Maybe some of you do. If you don't, then go ahead. It's AynRand BOT. And this is a Twitter account that I set up and I automated to tweet out really cool quotations from Ayn Rand. And I have various times set up throughout the day, and it's randomized. So once the whole database of quotations is gone through, it starts over again in random order, retweeting all the quotations out. I've got about 450 in the database right now, but I just collected a whole bunch more. And lately I've been collecting them from this book called Letters of Ayn Rand. And you can actually see some things about that book. If you go on Facebook, there's a Facebook page, Ayn Rand Bot Facebook page on Facebook that you can like and follow there. A lot of times when I'm pulling new quotations from books, I'll put a link there to the book that I'm sourcing it from. And this is one that I pulled out yesterday. And I think it's from page 435 to 436 of the letters book. It says, to make friends with slaves while they remain slaves is to support the regime of their masters. So she says, to make friends with slaves while they remain slaves is to support the regime of their masters, end quote. Now, the context for this was she was talking about members, citizens, people who are actually part of the Soviet regime coming to our country to participate in dialogues about various things. And when I read this, my thought was, well, could we make an analogy to the so-called interfaith dialogues that take place today, where you've got leaders of various religions? Well, of course, I don't think they ever invite some atheist leader to these things, because it's called interfaith dialogue. And if you don't have faith, then you're not invited, right? But, you know, is it true that we would say about these Muslims, at least the ones who are part of organized Islam, as Bosch would call it, that if we make friends with them, and they are in effect slaves of a certain kind, right? They are part of this ideology that tells them, I mean, it's very totalitarian in nature. It really is. It tells them all the different things that they have to do, the ways they have to live their life. So if we make friends with them while they remain slaves, are we supporting Islam itself? Now, in some ways, it seems clearly yes. That if we engage in interfaith dialogues, you know, for instance, I actually saw there was a course given at a university, or it was a symposium, where they were discussing the way that Muslims deal with teaching evolution versus creation in schools. As if, okay, well, you're just a religion like anybody else, you know, so let's go ahead and talk about the way that you deal with this issue, because, of course, Christians in our country have had to figure out what to do about whether they're going to teach evolution or whether they think you should teach only creationism, intelligent design, you know, whatever it is. So I think they lend credence to Islam. And again, if they get more people involved converting to Islam and then starting to become anti-Western, anti-freedom, anti-individual rights, then we are dooming ourselves, right? Hmm. So what do you think? Do you think Rand was right? Someone thought that the quote was actually good. Now, some people said, what do you do when you're talking to Muslims who eat pork? You know, what do you say to them? So we know a Muslim who eats some pork, right? What do you say to him? Do you tease him, right?
Oh, yeah. I always tease him. And he doesn't kill me. So I guess he's not a practitioner, but they go against Islamic bigotry, you know, they're against it on principle because it tastes too good, you know.
I mean, you know, her idea was then, you know, once they're liberated from their regime, then yes, be friends with them.
Of course, right.
But you shouldn't be friends with them while they are still slaves. Which part of Islam,
the worst thing, though, the worst thing.
The members of organized Islam, is that what you call it? People who actively go to mosque all the time,
these are the ones
you wouldn't be friends with?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, those who are part of mosques, you know, I mean, every terrorist is part of a mosque, every single last one. Every member of CARE, the stealth jihadists. So, yeah, I mean, when I refer to organized Islam, I'm talking about the countries, the Islamic countries, mosques. Individuals who are involved with Islam in their daily lives, when they go to mosque, when they help push Islam, every single last Muslim who's involved with that is part of the enemy, in the sense that they're organizing against us to Islamize every corner of the world in their own individual way. So yeah, they I'm sorry, what was I saying?
No, so then the question is, which ones can we be friends with then? So
the ones who don't give a damn. And
now,
that's, you know,
we can be friends with your one who, you know, he calls himself a Muslim, but he's got a dog, he eats pork.
And he, I always walk away alive after every encounter with him. So, and he knows about my work. So he's a non-Muslim Muslim. He's a Mino. He's a Muslim in name only.
Doesn't go to mosque.
Doesn't go to mosque. And you know what? I mean, you know, he was in some sort of trouble. So he didn't even read the Quran. He read an abridged version. He read like a Cliff Notes version.
Yeah, people in trouble often try to find religion to save them or something, right?
And
he read the Cliff Notes version?
Yeah. But I don't even think he read it, you know.
So if California became California.
California.
California, would your friend end up killing
if
you?
If my friend became a real Muslim, you know, that's a point. I mean, you know.
I mean, you really have to make decisions, right? So people have this same argument about trading with China.
Yeah, right.
If we're trading with China, if we're setting up factories and employing the Chinese over there, are we supporting the communist regime in
and
China?
Enemies. I mean,
or are they substantially not slaves enough to where what we're doing is pulling them towards
more
freedom?
Well, they
want
it both ways. They want it somewhat capitalism, somewhat control, somewhat dictatorship. Right. So they're going to probably bury themselves under that kind of, you know.
Anyway, these are thoughts to have, and it made me question more the motivation of those people who talk about the terminology issue and saying, oh, well, we need to encourage the moderate Muslims. We need to give them rhetorical space.
They've done nothing.
They don't have to face the truth, essentially, about
and again,
what the Quran says.
Some of the worst thing is when these non-Muslim Muslims, they say, oh, Osama bin Laden, he's not a Muslim.
Yeah.
He has nothing to do with Islam.
Yeah.
That's the worst.
And then, for the record, one discussion that I did have back and forth, like I said, the discussion on my blog really got crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But there was someone who posted on my blog, I think he called himself Hussein, and he said, Robert Spencer's interpretation of the Quran and Islam is all wrong. And he says, I'm a fan of Ayn Rand. I've read Atlas Shrugged twice, and I represent Islam, and, you know, Islam is
That's
good,
impossible.
Essentially. So I wrote back, and I said, I asked very specific questions about a couple of the items on that list that I read you guys earlier, you know, about things that Islam holds that you should, for instance, you know, he says, I make my own choices.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, what about the fact that Islam tells you that you need to follow the model of Muhammad in terms of your behavior so that you're not supposed to think for yourself and decide what to do? So I asked him these questions, never got a response.
Never got, because there is no response.
So
you know what? He might even be a Muslim. He might be a leftist pretending. He might be.
I don't know. But
how the hell can... Also, one thing. It's not the point about objectivism, how radical it is to most people, even in America. But she's a woman. I mean, if he was a Muslim, I have to admit, though, when I found out Ayn Rand was a woman, I was very surprised. Maybe it's my upbringing. You know, I was raised with misogynist culture. I mean, it was what it was.
It's the Muslim in you.
I was, it was my inner Muslim. He was like, what? A woman? But it's true. I was like, I was really surprised because the power, the ideas, the philosophy, I was like, this is a woman. Wow.
Yeah.
And what a thing.
Now, he says, you are encouraging this totalitarian ideology by trying to find a name for the nonviolent right now apologists. That is, you know, I don't know that I'm trying to find a name for them, though.
No.
Right? I'm just trying to name the ones that foreign policy actions
The reason why we're talking about this right now is because our government has not done their job.
Yeah.
They have not destroyed the enemy beyond a shadow of a doubt to the point where, you know, it's like the only time. Imagine if we were trying to moderate Shinto and Nazism during the war, World War II. The only time that they changed was when we destroyed them physically.
Which leads us to our next topic, which is the foreign policy debate and what we can learn from it. And did Newt Gingrich make as big a gaffe as people say that he did with regard to his comments on amnesty? I'm actually going to argue that no, he didn't. I don't know that that's such a surprise to people here, but I have what I think is an interesting argument as to why. So they started out all talking about the Patriot Act. So we got to hear what the candidates' various positions were on the Patriot Act. Gingrich himself says you divide national security from criminal law. In criminal law, we have, you know, innocent until proven guilty. You have to show particularized suspicion, presumably. He only said innocent until proven guilty, which is actually a different issue. We want to know whether there has to be particularized suspicion before the government can invade your privacy, so to speak. And he says, with regard to the Patriot Act, he is in favor of extending it and, in fact, would even perhaps strengthen it. And as you might know about the Patriot Act, there are different provisions in there that require routine reporting of personal data about you, your financial transactions, et cetera, to the government without any particularized suspicion about you. So what's Gingrich's position? He would extend it long term. He would perhaps even strengthen it. And he says, I've spent years studying, you know, pretentious windbag, sorry. You know, and he's fear-mongering by talking about you know, what would happen if we have one nuclear weapon. And, you know, he says, we need many more tools to fight this. He doesn't draw a line you know, what is off limits for the government in this context. And very ominously, he says, look, we're going to be dealing with this threat, quote unquote, for the rest of our lives.
I mean, think about that.
We're just supposed to accept that we're going to deal with this threat
this
for the rest of our lives.
And this guy is campaigning to become president.
Yeah.
He can't put a stop to this enemy, to this threat.
So completely hopeless. No idea of a proper foreign policy that says, let's fight the war. Let's eliminate the threat. You know, and I've quoted this so many different times from your own book and Alex Epstein. They have the just war theory versus American self-defense. And they state in there the touchstone, which is that you identify the enemy and then you do whatever is necessary to eliminate the threat with minimal loss of life and liberty on the part of American civilians and soldiers. So this idea that you're going to have the Patriot Act, a strengthened version of the Patriot Act going on, ad infinitum is just ridiculous. So he says, for the rest of our lives, we just have to accept this is a fact of life. That's
Gingrich. Have to accept that jihad is a fact of life.
Now, then we have Ron Paul as the champion of liberty, comes out and says, look, you know, the founding fathers say that we shouldn't be willing to sacrifice liberty for security, which is true. And he says, you know, we should never have to do this. He says we can still provide security without sacrificing the Bill of Rights. That's great. But what does he cite as the example of the terrorist threat? It's Timothy McVeigh.
Three times.
Yes.
I've never heard him say jihad ever. So as if Timothy McVeigh is a global terrorist organization.
And I don't know if it's because he has respect for Islam because it's a religion and he's religious.
I say, yeah.
Is that why?
I
mean, you know, Timothy McVeigh is his only example of a terrorist. Now, Gingrich is funny. He says, well, look, Timothy McVeigh succeeded, and our goal is actually to prevent people like him from succeeding.
Right.
But again, you can't have prevention as a goal, not for any extended period of time.
Right.
The idea of living in a constant state of emergency, it is terrible.
And no one said anything that they're going to do something about that, right? That they're going to actually return us back to that time when we didn't have to worry.
No.
About New York going up.
There's another candidate, and when I get to it, I'll tell you which one, who had said, basically, as far as the eye can see, we're going to be dealing with counterterrorism. I think that was Huntsman or Putzman, as you like to call him. You know, Ron Paul comes back and says, you know, we can't have a police state. He says, you know, the crime is against the American people. We shouldn't do this. And he's right.
In that small, narrow way, yes.
Yeah,
he has nothing to say against the enemy.
Now, Bachman, she was vague. She says, look, we've got a different kind of war. We have to have different techniques. And
yeah, she's very political when it comes to this.
But, you know, the thing that was bad that she said is that she implied that because we have this increase in technology, that therefore the mere increase in technology means that we have to change the way that we investigate something. And I submit that you can still apply principles in the context of changing technology. The fact that technology changes doesn't change the underlying principle, and that, again, you should have particularized suspicion before the government is allowed to investigate, you know, something in terms of that would require the violation of your rights to property or contract, which is what all these things would do. You know, for example, just to give you one example of the Patriot Act, if you have a transaction at a bank that's over a certain amount, and I think now the threshold amount is only $5,000, it's gone down over time. You would expect it to go up because our dollar is worthless, relatively speaking, but it's gone down. If your transaction exceeds that threshold amount, it's automatically reported to the government because potentially you might be involved in terrorism. Maybe you're funding Hamas or something, right?
It's unbelievable.
You could see this done in minor ways as a temporary measure in order to get through an emergency. But if their idea is, look, we're not going to fight a proper war.
They have
and
no intention. They have no intention.
We're going to subject American people to Patriot Act pat-downs forever. Then it's wrong. So you get so torn because Ron Paul seemed to be the only one who really got this. Now, the one thing that was interesting is she said, well, look, the ACLU has been
Michelle
in charge.
Michelle Bachmann.
The one good thing that – another good thing that Michelle Bachmann said, or actually this is really the only good direction that she had in her comments.
Right.
She reiterated something she said before, which is that the ACLU has been in charge of our interrogation, that they have been saying that we can't use enhanced interrogation techniques, torture, to get the information out of these guys. It is true that if we weren't crippled in that way – if we just went ahead and interrogated people the way that we needed to, then there might be less need to use things like the Patriot Act
right.
to infringe the rights of American citizens in the name of fighting terrorism.
All these exist because of the default of our government.
So she was vague. She didn't really say one way or the other about the Patriot Act, but she sort of implied that the reason that we're stuck with something like the Patriot Act is because we're not doing our job. Huntsman says, oh, we have to preserve our name brand around the world and
terrible.
Values and balancing act.
We're
a
shining
balance
city.
Liberty with security. Very vague out of there.
Terrible.
Now, by the time they got to Romney, they morphed the question. This happened numerous times in the debate. So the question morphed to starting out talking about the TSA. And he says, you know, we can do better than the TSA. And he hints at being allowed to profile. But he sides with Gingrich with respect to the issue of treating criminal law issues versus issues of war.
To the point of what Ahmadinejad wants to indict.
Oh, yeah, he wants to indict
Ahmadinejad.
He said that later in the debate. Yeah, he's going to indict him. That's really going to help.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're talking about two different legal systems. And here's the thing. When you talk about criminals at home and foreign policy abroad, it's the same issue. It's them initiating force against us. So why is it, I mean, you'd say, okay, well, criminals at home, you're going to grant them certain civil rights. Terrorists abroad, you're not going to give them certain civil rights. Okay, that's fine. I'm fine with that, right? Because there's rights guaranteed to citizens under the Constitution. People who live here and agree to, you know, live here, they're going to be treated a certain way. If you live in the United States, you're going to be treated a certain way by the government that has a monopoly on the physical, you know, use of physical force in this area. That's fine. But that doesn't mean that when you're dealing with war issues that you wipe out civil rights for Americans.
Right.
You could say, okay, we're not going to give civil rights to people who are here with green cards from certain countries.
Right.
You know, but just Americans on the streets. I mean, why do they care if I have a transaction over $5,000 in the bank?
Right.
Unless they have some particularized suspicion about me, right?
But they want to avoid being considered racists.
Perry's solution to the TSA, let's go ahead and privatize. I don't think privatizing something means that it actually becomes a private function necessarily. Sometimes it's privatized, but it's under government supervision. So that doesn't necessarily...
Yeah, they'll still have their leeches on.
Yeah, they'll still give us those insane pat-downs. Then the Patriot Act. Perry, he says, keep the Patriot Act and perhaps even strengthen it with new technology. And he says we have to...
They love that name.
Get better intelligence.
Now,
Santorum says yes to profiling because by the time the question got to him, it turned into profiling, and he says, yes, we should profile. But Santorum is one of these process people. Do you know the people who say, well, we're going to decide on our policies by having a certain sort of a debate? Here in the United States, we have this open debate, and then once we set these policies, and therefore it's the result of a fair process, and so therefore it's fair. That's the kind of
it's
thing
acceptable.
That... Yeah, it's acceptable because it's the result of this process of having a debate.
And don't forget that Santorum said in the last debate that we should be friends with Pakistan because they have nukes. Meaning, I guess, we won't be friends with Iran until they get nukes. Anyway.
Yeah, and Bachman said something interesting about that in this debate we'll get to in a second. So Santorum would say, yes, go ahead and profile Muslims. And it was funny because Ron Paul's right next to him at the time. And he's gesturing. He's like, oh, my God, profiling Muslims. This is terrible, right? And he says, if we do this, we are digging a hole for ourselves.
Who said?
That's Ron Paul.
Yes.
And he says, again, what about Timothy McVeigh?
Right.
And he says, terrorism is a tactic. We haven't declared war. You know,
well, he's right about that.
And he, you know, then he talks about the fact that by the definition of the current laws about who could be vulnerable to being assassinated, that all Americans are vulnerable. Who knows? You know, he doesn't have time in his 30 seconds to give us the actual wording of the law. Now, with Cain actually started out good in his response because he says he is maybe in favor of reforming the Patriot Act, but we should keep those parts that we need. So at least he was not on the side of pushing to strengthen
right.
it. Like some of these other bozos, it's like, okay, look,
bigger.
You know, the concern is that we're infringing on the rights of American citizens. And Cain comes in and at least says, okay, maybe we should reform it and improve it. But then he was trying to have his cake and eat it too with regard to the issue of profiling Muslims.
Yeah.
He implied that he was in favor of it. And then when he was asked point blank about it, he said,
no
profiling Muslims. But he says, you're oversimplifying. So then he comes in to complexify it. And in effect, he's saying, you have a government bureaucracy that euphemizes some characteristics that you can use to, in effect, profile Muslims without saying that you are. That's what Cain was implying in his answer.
Like a good politician.
Yeah, it's the have your cake and eat it too answer. It reminded me of the issue of affirmative action. When schools were told that they could not have these programs, that they did affirmative action based on race, their response was, oh, well, let's come up with a proxy for race. And the proxy for race will be income level. And we'll go ahead and give affirmative action according to income level. And we'll get what we wanted in the end anyway. So, you know, that's the kind of thing he's talking about doing here.
How many others besides young Muslim Arab males have flown planes into buildings? How many?
Michael says, Putzman, Amy. Remember, it's Putzman.
Yeah.
Okay, Putzman.
Putzman.
He's Mr. Preamble, as far as I'm concerned. All of his answer is a preamble with
That's
10
terrible.
Seconds of substance at the end. That's what bothers me the most
he
about
doesn't matter,
him.
Actually, he just keeps talking.
Now, Pakistan. Big issue was, do we continue to fund Pakistan? Is Pakistan even plausibly our ally? None of the people on the panel seem to think that Pakistan was our ally. But Michelle Bachman said something that I thought was very, very revealing. You know, she talks about the fact that we don't want to lose Pakistan, you know, influence with them. They have 15 nuke sites that are accessible to terrorists. You know, China could come in there. We don't want to lose our influence. She says we should still continue to give them money, but demand more for our money in terms of the intelligence that
they've never given us anything.
Yeah, that Obama's not being demanding enough. Now, they have given us some things, but from what I understand, what they've given us is pitiful.
Just enough to justify all the dough.
Yeah, just enough to justify the money. So the phrase that she used, which I thought was very revealing, was too nuclear to fail. Too nuclear to fail.
And it didn't work on the audience or anything.
Well, of course it didn't work. Because, I mean, look, where did she get the phrase from? She got it from too big to fail, which meant that you're going to give them a bailout, which is money down a hole.
Which is what Islam means peaceful.
All the bailouts from the too big to fail.
The bailout.
Yeah. So that was a tremendous Freudian slip. Why she would even use...
Yeah, it stunk.
That phrase, because she's saying too nuclear to fail, therefore we have to keep throwing money at them.
Phew.
And of course, does it even work anyway?
No.
Right?
Let's go in there and let's take over the nukes.
As soon as
we're so worried about them.
As soon as they decide they don't need our money, then they'll just give the nukes to Al-Qaeda. Or, you know, maybe Al-Qaeda will be able to offer more money for the nukes because people will give the money to Al-Qaeda.
They're saying we have nukes.
Maybe our money goes to Al-Qaeda for all we know. Who knows?
Of course it does. There are elements within Pakistan government who are in bed with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Anyway, I just thought that was funny. Too nuclear to fail. It's so wrong. It's complete. Why she even said it, I don't know. Perry, he's always been good. They have to show, Pakistan has to show that they have our interests in mind, or no bucks for them. Okay, now Afghanistan, you know, should we get out? Should we not get out? Putman says
okay,
we should get out.
Of course.
Romney says, you know, we've spent $450 billion. We've had all these casualties. We have to prevent it from becoming a terrorist launching pad.
Mm-hmm.
So we would go ahead and draw down the troops, but we would go ahead and defer to the commanders on the ground with respect to the timeline.
Leave with some major bombs, drop some bombs, and tell them, warn them.
Yeah.
If you make any move against us, we're going to kill you.
Yeah, he says, don't cut and run. Putman argues, he says, look, we have to have only 10 to 15. I'm trying to come around to your terminology. He says 10 to 15. If I was a good talk show host, I'd have really vicious nicknames for all these people.
Michael Savage has one of the most vicious ones. Against Rush Limbaugh, he says, hush, bimbo, hush. And he also, for Sean Hannity, he calls him Pawn Vanity. Very funny.
But
very
he has
funny.
Other ones, too.
Oh, he's
right?
Nasty, yeah.
Instead of Kofi Annan.
Instead of Kofi Annan, he's called him Coffee Cup Annan. I used to call him Kofi Annan Entity.
Yes.
Also, Condoleezza Rice Cerrone, just to dismiss her. That's pretty funny.
Anyway, so I have to do this, but, you know, Putman comes out on the side of, you know, President's Commander-in-Chief, we can do what we think is right regardless of what the commanders on the ground recommend. We do what we think is the right answer. Now, Gingrich, you know, the question comes around to him, and in usual form, he's attacking Wolf Blitzer,
right.
Both on the substance of, you know, what is the question by the time it comes to me? And I can
right.
I can sympathize with him because, as I said, during this debate, I saw the question kind of morph as it went. And sometimes he'd say, okay, well, we're still on the same topic, but we're going to let another question come in on the same topic.
Right.
So then by the time the question gets to you, if you're the fifth person down the row,
yeah,
there's three questions on the table, right?
And it was a long debate, too, so I don't get it.
Yeah. But both on the substance and the rules, he didn't know how much time he had. But then he says, look, you know, we're all talking about the fact that after we killed bin Laden, that the U.S. and Pakistan relations weren't as good. And he says, of course, that's how it should be, right? But
they were hiding them.
Yeah, I mean, we should not have a good relationship with Pakistan after we saw that they were hiding them all these years. So that was good, got some cheers. And the thing I did like that he mentioned is that he talked about changing the rules of engagement.
Right.
And all I have to say to these politicians is good luck changing the rules of engagement, because the current rules of engagement,
they might as well be the golden rules of engagement.
They're taught in all the military academies in our country. So they're going to have a huge uphill battle. If they're serious, I mean, I hope they are about changing these rules of engagement. They need to do something. But, you know, this is nuts, this idea.
Jeopardizing our soldiers for guilty civilians, innocent civilians, whatever they want to call them.
Yeah, who was it that had said the other day that we shouldn't go into a fight trying to make it a fair fight? We should
Bolton.
Only... It was Bolton, right. Yeah.
We should not be engaged with that type of stuff. I mean,
this idea of a fair fight.
We have the power.
Yeah, we should always be in total lopsided fights where
we
have the strength and the
we
power.
We could destroy, again, our enemies overnight.
Yeah.
We just pretend that we have to wage these non-war wars for decades.
So Santorum also mentioned changing the rules of engagement, which is good. Then the question came, would you help Israel to attack Iran? And Kane comes in with a decent answer. He says if they've got a credible plan for success, then he would go ahead and come in and give them help. You have to have a clear mission and a good definition of victory as well. Come on in. Ron Paul says no, and he doesn't expect it to happen anyway. And he says that there's Israeli military advisors who have retired, and they all
he
say
named,
no.
He cited one.
Yeah, he cited one
because he agrees with them.
Yeah.
That's why I cited him.
Yeah, of course. So after Paul comes in with his answer saying that it's unlikely to happen anyway, then he says, they go back to Kane. And Kane says, well, I didn't say it was likely. So
right.
Kane started backpedaling
after
hearing Ron Paul's answer, which
yep.
I didn't like. Then there was a question about sanctions in Iran. Do they actually do any good? And then Perry brought up the idea of sanctioning the Iranian Central Bank, that might do it.
How about bombing Iran?
Yeah, but they want to sanction the Iranian Central Bank so that they can't do anything, and then have a no-fly zone over Syria simultaneously. That's Perry's plan. Now, Gingrich says we need a surplus of energy here to replace all this Iranian oil, because everyone says, well, we don't want to sanction Iran because then the European economy, which is on a fragile thread at best, is going to completely collapse because they can't buy the oil for cheap. It's all going to get too expensive. So if we want to replace the Iranian oil, we have to allow energy development here, which is true. So every issue is interconnected, you know, and Gingrich says, look, you know, if we work at it, if we're serious about it, we could get within 1 year a number of oil fields up and running such that we wouldn't be so dependent on these people. And I suspect this is true as well. If we had enough oil here at home so we could just get out of buying any oil from that entire region.
That's all they have. They only import oil and terrorism and Islam.
Yeah, I mean, and how could they fund the terrorism without the money from
the
oil? That maybe should be job one.
They're slothful.
Yeah.
You know, Islam says nothing about work, nothing about the work ethic.
Both Gingrich and Santorum use the radical Islam term, which is good.
Relatively speaking, for politicians in a debate, yeah.
Yeah. Bachman was pretty decent, especially on the issue of Iran. She says, look, this is not just an idle threat. They've actually said openly that they want to destroy both Israel and us with a nuclear weapon, so you need to do that.
Oh, sorry, one thing. Chris asked, what do we bomb in Iran? Iran has been killing Americans for 30 years. Doesn't matter what we bomb, as long as we bomb them.
If we can
kill all the mullahs in one shot, go for it.
Well, it would be good to take out the nuclear sites.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the biggest thing. If we could figure it out.
But we have to make them pay for what they've done, and we never, ever, ever have.
Yeah. Now, it was, I believe, Gingrich, because Gingrich is usually the best and most articulate and specific about actual tactics. He says, look, I would go ahead and use force against Iran to get the nukes out of there, but only as part of a regime change.
Yeah. I mean, he's the only one who said that, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's
good. And he tied it specifically. You don't go in there and just bomb nuclear sites and then not actually change the regime. You would have to do that as well. So I thought that was good. Now, Santorum, oh my gosh, wimpy.
Yeah.
He had a whole spiel about it. Sanborum is your name for him.
Sanborum. Yes.
So this is good. So he wanted us to continue sending money, foreign aid, to other countries to fight AIDS and all these other things.
It's unbelievable.
Because it helps to stabilize.
It's unbelievable.
And
we have the money, first of all. You know, at any point, we have, even if we had a healthy economy,
yeah,
it's a terrible thing to even offer today.
You know, we're
for what?
Supposedly,
what do we get in return?
Supposedly we need to spend money on healthcare here, but we're sending all this money overseas. And it's got to be the altruist idea within Santorum's, you know, very serious religious background that is speaking here. He says, we want to promote our values over there, promote our values. And then he says, you know, as part of America, part of our nature as Americans is to come to the aid of those who are in trouble in the world. And my thought was, look, he's one-upped Romney here. If you remember Romney, it was a couple months ago, and I did a blog post on this. Romney says that the GOP is the party that supports those who are in need.
Right.
Right?
But that's how he defined the GOP.
Right. And he was talking about that in the context of domestic policy, helping those among Americans who are in need, namely giving them health care or whatever it was. So these are the sorts of things, you know. And actually, I think the particular topic then was Social Security.
Okay.
He didn't want to eliminate
He was arguing
social,
against Rick Perry.
Right,
who
right.
called for him to
Perry says it's
out.
Reform it. But, you know, Romney says no, because it's in the nature of the GOP that we help, you know, those in need. Santorum's putting on the scale of the entire world.
Yes, he is. It's unbelievable.
So
altruism.
Saw Romney and raised him quite
a
bit.
Dollars.
Yeah, your tax dollars at work.
And you know what? He also says in a whiny way. If you notice Sanborum, he's like always whining about it.
Yeah.
In some way, it's like, damn, because he knows he's going to lose.
Kane, like I said, no major flubs in this debate. The big,
he has to distinguish himself from his politicians.
Yeah, the trying to have your cake and eat it too with respect to profiling Muslims, I didn't like that response.
Yeah.
I did like the fact, though, that he was willing to scale back on the Patriot Act
right.
somewhat, but he doesn't go to the extreme of a Ron Paul position. here with respect to different foreign aid programs. He says, we have to look at our priorities and whether the program has been successful in achieving the ends it's supposed to achieve. He always wants to see the results and then make a decision. So it's sort of an empty answer, but at least he says, look, are we getting something out of it?
Right.
Ron Paul says, the aid is worthless. He says, you're taking the money from poor people here in the United States and you're giving it to rich people in poor countries.
That plays with the crowd and they like it.
Yeah, he says, let's export our principles instead, our free market principles. And, of course, that is a better answer. Romney says we have
to learn the free market principles first.
Now, Romney was funny. He says, we can take the dollars from Obamacare and keep the dollars for the different expenses for the military budget, for instance. And Paul was so funny. He says, they aren't cutting anything out of anything. He says, all this is just talk.
It's tough.
And
it's true. But he was right. It's tough to admit, but he was absolutely right. He says, these guys are basically nibbling away at this, at this monster.
Yeah. So what does Romney want to do? Give crippling sanctions to Iran. He wants to indict
Ahmadinejad. That's so stupid.
He says, no price.
Submit Romney.
No price. Like, suppose our oil prices went up and stuff. He says, no price is worth an Iranian nuke. And he says, as president, his first foreign trip would be to Israel. Now, Gingrich says he wants to go ahead and make cuts to defense sometimes. He says, look, if Apple changes technology every 9 months, then we can do better than we do with regard to changing
our military
technology.
I'm glad that he broached that, at least.
Yeah. We should be able to develop our oil. That was one of his big
priorities. No, because this idea, if you start talking about cuts in defense, people go crazy. It's like, really should. We should. We should be a little more light.
But he was the one who would come out and say, yes, he would bomb
Iran
as a last resort to get rid of the nukes. He says, but we need regime change at the same time.
Right.
So he wouldn't accept just the bombing and then leaving it.
And no one else backed him up on that, huh?
I think that probably Kane would.
No, he would, but no one else in the debate actually said yes.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Of course, like I said, the questions keep morphing as they go from one to the other. Putzman, no sacred cows. We have to strategize our spending, blah, 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 blah.
He's terrible.
For me, look, I say stop buying oil. Stop buying their oil and have a strong self-defense. How far would that go towards eliminating the
change
threat?
The world. Our world and theirs.
I really do. I really do think it would. Wolf Blitzer was funny. He tried to get them to sign on to compromise by quoting Ronald Reagan. So you appeal to the authority of Ronald Reagan by quoting from his memoirs where Reagan said that if you get 70-80% of what you want, then you go ahead and compromise and things are cool. So he asked Santorum.
On the record.
And he wants all these politicians to say that they would compromise and raise taxes. It's like that's their big thing in the world. If a Republican will just agree to raise taxes, then we know we've got them,
that's
you know?
Right. Right.
And not that it's going to solve the problem, because I think they know it's not going to solve a problem at all.
No.
Right?
But to raise taxes, that's their goal.
Yeah. So anyway, this question goes to Santorum. And Santorum, he says, well, it depends on what 70-80% that you get. And he seemed to explain how you could have so-called compromise on minor issues without compromising your principles. But what Santorum treats as a principle versus what we would treat as a principle.
I know.
He says it anyway. Gingrich talks about his Social Security reform plan, which sounds darn good, by the way. It's the Chilean idea, which it's now finally been spoken about in substance during these debates. You've heard Kane, give lip service to the Chilean reforms of Social Security.
Okay, so maybe Gingrich picked it up from there? Or
yeah, so this is what they did. They said you could have a personal account instead of the government, collecting your money. And they said that if your personal account yields less than you would have gotten through their equivalent of Social Security, then the government would make up the difference.
Okay.
So they allow you to have that personal control over your investment for your retirement, but no downside. And probably because they were convinced that people managing their own money would do better than the government managing it. They were right. The government has not had to make up the difference for 30 years. Now, it is true that there's been a variation in the amount that each person yields in their account. So for people who have made similar incomes and have contributed similar amounts into these personal accounts, some people would have a yield that is three times the amount that their Social Security system would have paid out. Some people have a yield that is about 1.5 times, but nonetheless, none of it has fallen below. It's always been more than they would have gotten had they stayed within the government
right.
program. So,
and Gingrich brought us up. Did anyone else back him up there or no?
People, I think, liked it, but I don't know if they actually got a chance to respond to that in particular, because I think the question morphed again after
right,
that.
Right.
But
did anyone complain about the morphing questions?
Well, Gingrich, like
okay.
I said, he says, what question am I answering now? But, you know, 72% of the GDP is in savings in Chile. So they have an amount being saved in Chile now that is 72% of, I guess, their annual GDP. And this, of course, helps the economy because that savings constitutes investment. So it sounds very promising. That would be nice to see. So then we're talking about this issue of immigration and borders, right? The one thing I wanted to point out was Michelle Bachmann made this slip up. She had talked about the debt deal, right? And she made the same slip that I made when I first started this show, when I couldn't keep track of the billions versus the trillions.
That's right.
She said that in the debt deal, that they had authorized an extra $2.4 billion in spending. $2.4 billion is nothing in the scale of our economy anymore, I learned very quickly. So it's $2.4 trillion, of course. So she brought up this idea that we heard from Mark Stein during the Restoration Weekend. By the way, Mark Stein's book, After America, is depressing.
Yes. Well written, though. It's very entertaining at the same time.
He gave a talk where he just gave some of the stats.
Yeah, we
what
saw
we're
him
looking at.
At the Restoration Week. We also saw Ann Coulter, and she knew of Pigmen. But anyway, sorry.
Nice. But yeah, so Mark Stein talks about the fact that the way that our debt is going and the way that we don't pay the debt back, but we just keep paying interest on it, in a certain number of years, I forget it was 10 years or something,
yeah,
our interest on the debt that we owe China will pay for the entire Chinese military.
Yeah.
And this is a really disturbing statistic, and Bachmann brought up that statistic. So at least some of these candidates are aware of the
Mark Stein's book.
She did not cite Mark Stein's
book. Because she
has
in the past.
Oh, okay. So then she probably did learn it from him.
Right.
In terms of the border issue, so many of them said the first issue is to have border security. A number of them talked about the fact that we are concerned that terrorists will come in through the borders. And also some have talked about, I think it was actually Kane. Yeah, Kane actually brought up the statistic that 40% of the people in Mexico believe that theirs is a failed state. And so that if we don't fix the border problem, they're more likely to want to move here. And he also said people killed in Mexico. I think he might have mean American citizens. That there's been as many people killed in Mexico as have been killed in Afghanistan. I'd want to see those statistics.
Know.
I have no idea. I thought that was interesting as well. But, you know, they all want to promote the path to legal citizenship. The big controversy over the immigration issue was between Gingrich, who said that we should go ahead and, in effect, grant amnesty for certain
groups.
How
did the audience react? Because I missed that part. How did the audience react?
They were pretty silent.
Okay.
I don't think they booed him, right?
Okay.
You know, he was saying, look, the Republican Party...
Because the pundits went crazy.
Yeah, the Republican Party is the party of families. And so if you have immigrant families, even though they're illegal immigrants, they've been here for 20, 25 years, they've had kids, they run businesses, they have paid taxes, a lot of
yep.
them. A lot of them pay taxes. I don't know how they do it with their various documents that they get by working with. So they've been here all this time. They're established. And then he says, are you just going to uproot them and kick them out?
And who asked that? Did
Gingrich.
Okay.
Gingrich. And so then he's saying, well, we're not going to give them citizenship, but we'll give them some sort of legal status that's less than citizenship. Romney says, oh, no, if you give them amnesty, it's going to be a magnet and more of them are going to come.
Well, then he said citizenship, didn't he? He said, sorry, a few years ago he said.
Yeah.
So Romney did want to give him citizenship a few years ago, but no,
he's
running for president.
Oh, so now he's changed his mind. Yeah, yeah. So you know,
but that's Romney.
But you know, first of all, Gingrich did not say give them citizenship.
Right.
Also, he said that for people who were here shorter periods of time, who don't have significant ties to the United States, he would send them back, right?
So you, also criminals. I mean, you know.
Obviously criminals. Yeah. Obviously people with diseases or, you know, terrorists, of course, are out of here, whatever. But he's talking about people who just came here to support themselves.
Who become part of the system.
And, yeah, and they've been here for, you know, for a long time. And this is thought of as scandalous that he shot his candidacy in the foot.
Rush Limbaugh actually took a far more, I hate the word, but a more nuanced approach. And said it wasn't as bad as everyone made out to be.
It's not as bad as everybody made out to be. And here's my thought on this. It seems that when you have lived here peacefully all those years, and the American government has turned a blind eye, winked at you, whatever they've done, there's something analogous to a statute of limitations that would kick in for people who have been here. Now, I don't know where you want to draw the line, you know, cut a certain number of years.
But there are some true believers who believe you kick them all out.
Yeah.
You know, kick them all out. It's like kill all Muslims.
Right.
That same attitude.
Right. And there wasn't among the answers here enough principle distinction between the goodies that you would give people versus just not kicking them out.
Right.
So you could say, well, you can't have citizenship and you can't have free health care.
Was it mainly,
you know,
Romney and Gingrich talking, or did someone say anything worthwhile?
Yeah, mostly between Romney and Gingrich. But, you know, Bachman came in and pressed him on it a lot. She says,
Press Gingrich,
yeah. She says, I would not make 11 million workers legal, no Dream Act at the federal level. Perry
wanted to give, you know, free college note. Didn't want to give like a two.
And this is the funny thing. Nobody called Perry on the fact that he wanted to give in-state college tuition in his state.
And he didn't bring it up and say, hey,
this is funny. Perry himself used the words, yes, we need to stop the magnets.
Oh, my.
He created a magnet in his own state of Texas by giving the in-state college tuition.
And they didn't call him out. They should have called him out because they would have knocked him over.
Yeah. So, you know, they all say securing the border is the biggest thing, and then they can worry about other things. But, you know, with Romney, he says 25 years, he says that's a very extreme exception. He's not going to draw the line anywhere, but he doesn't want to give amnesty because he doesn't want to create a magnet. And let's have legal programs. And they all say, a few of them have been saying, and even Michelle Bachman cites Steve Jobs on this point, that we should give special consideration with respect to immigration to those people who graduate here with math, science, engineering degrees. That, you know, Steve Jobs in his book cited the fact that he moved some of his manufacturing to China because he couldn't find 30,000 engineers who could work and build his products, that we don't have those people here. And the answer of all these people is, well, let's go ahead and put a green card, staple a green card to the college diploma of anybody who's come here and got the, you know, gotten these technical degrees. I always joke and I say, well, what, you know, what about the philosophy PhDs? And they don't want us, but instead they want these technical people. You know, I think that they don't want anybody who's smart enough to see through their actual ideas. They want people who have their nose in the books as engineers. Not that engineers aren't philosophical, but, you know, by and large, they're, you know, worried about things in the real world, creating these products. And sometimes they're not as philosophical as we like. Steve Jobs, case in point, if he had, you know, applied a consistent philosophy throughout his life, it would have been so much better. But, yeah, they want to make a fast track to citizenship or at least legal working status to those immigrants that get those technical degrees. Most of them want to kick everybody else out, but, you know, why can't they just say, look, we don't have to give them citizenship. Yeah, suppose you're worried about the fact that suddenly there's going to be a whole bunch of new Democratic voters. I think that's one worry
have. That's their main worry, a lot of them.
So don't give them citizenship. Allow them to work legally. Don't give them freebies. And don't split up their families, as Gingrich says. I mean, they're supposedly the party of family values, but in any event. So I didn't see Gingrich's position as, you know, being that terrible. I don't see why he would completely undermine his candidacy as a result of that answer. Do you?
No.
But that's what most people are saying, right?
Yes, but they may have lost some steam, though, this past week, because they know what's at stake.
Now, here's Michael some of these issues that we've talked about with respect to the debate. We're seeing some comments here in the chat room. He says, I call for the absolute profiling of Muslims in a very specific way. The FBI should scrutinize all mosques on U.S. territory and perhaps even the individuals who are in leadership roles in those mosques.
And one thing also, no imam is innocent because he understands the content of the Quran and Islam. So even if Muslims who go to the mosque don't know, he knows. He knows what Islam means.
Michael says, in terms of just war theory, which is the basis for our current rules of engagement, he says, just war theory is the marriage of self-defense with self-sacrifice. And those, of course, can't be married. It's oil and water, trying to mix those.
Islam and peace, oil and water, yeah.
Yeah. Now they're talking about where to bomb in Iran, and I think it's the...
Where to bomb, it's like this. You know, Iran has been wanting nukes for 30 years. We should give them just one. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Here's a live one.
Yeah, will bombing make the bad ideas go away? I mean, no. This is the problem with picking sides. You say, okay, well, we want to help.
It will scare the hell out of
the
insurgents
or the rebellion. Who are they?
If you make them pay a heavy price for what they're doing, they'll be a little more hesitant to continue doing what they're doing. I mean, they take it further.
Now, Chris here says he wishes Ron Paul would acknowledge the threat of Islam and be clear that it would what
he
it would take.
He never does.
To...
He likes Islam.
No,
Islam's
he doesn't.
Great.
And he says the only reason that they don't like us is because we are over there.
Ron Paul.
And this is the deal. My answer to him is, okay, look, maybe they're not happy that we're over there. That could be true.
I think he's a crypto Muslim because, you know, he never said anything else.
I have no idea, but. You know, if we're over there for a legitimate reason, it doesn't matter that they don't like it. It just goes with the territory.
You know, he says they're here because, you know, because we're there. It's like, so, you know, meaning 9/11, they were justified. If they nuke us, they're justified because we were there, whatever that means.
So that was our foreign policy debate. I do think we learned something. We learned who wants to push the Patriot Act further.
Right. And expand government.
Yeah.
Gingrich, Romney.
Right.
Perry. I think all the others.
Yeah.
And
Cain
was a little more
thoughtful. Cain did not say he would expand it. Bachman had some comments in the right direction. She's generally good on foreign policy, except for that issue of Pakistan. And that too nuclear to fail comment was so revealing.
Michael said demoralization of the enemy is absolutely essential. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You have to make them lose their faith in a serious way.
Yeah.
By military action.
And here's why I think, you know, really doing a spectacular bombing of the nuclear sites
absolutely.
Could do it with respect to Iran.
No
it's
doubt.
Because Ahmadinejad, in speech after speech after speech, has been upholding that program as a crown jewel
absolutely.
Of their regime.
Without that,
so,
they're nothing. And
they
know it.
I don't know that you would have to do major bombing of civilian centers in order to demoralize them.
No, you've got to knock out the mullahs. If you know where they are,
right.
you've got to bomb them. You've got to
right.
kill them.
Right. So let's go on to something just for a couple minutes that's a little bit more pleasant. As some of you know, the NBA, National Basketball Association, has reached a tentative deal to save what's left of the season.
66 games instead of 82.
66 games.
The Lakers can have an opportunity to redeem themselves from that horrific exit that they made last year against the Mavericks. But Mavericks were, you know, great champion anyway. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. So it Christmas Day, we get... three different games on
probably Lakers, the Heat, who knows? We'll see.
So
I'm a basketball fan. I love basketball. Yeah. It started with Jordan, you know, years ago. I saw him and that was it.
Now we knew that this possibility of the lockout was coming. It was because they had a 5-year collective bargaining agreement, began in 2006, expired at the end of June, I believe, of 2011. And they put off trying to reach a deal, and you know, before you know it, 2 months of the season is gone. I tried to do some research on the history of the so-called National Basketball Players Association, this union, to try to figure out how did it get its power, what kind of power does it have, and I found that it was hard to find what I needed to know. Why? Because the establishment of unions and the power that they have seems to just be taken for granted in this country. Under the Wagner Act, all you have to do is certify a union, and it becomes certified, I guess by the National Labor Relations Board or something, it becomes certified when a majority of the workers in that industry vote for that particular union to represent them. Once the majority goes ahead and votes for them, and then it's certified, then that entity has the authority to bargain on behalf of all the people. So even if you're part of the minority that objected, you are bound by what this union bargains for on your behalf. So that's how they're stuck in this mess. And all the players, they're saying we're not getting enough money. And the owners, whom I'm sympathetic, they say, look, we are losing money. As it turns out, the compromise is doing things to so-called level the playing field, which is garbage. They ended up disbanding the union, and I don't know what that's going to mean in the long term. But just know unions, anti-freedom, anti-individual rights, are the culprit here in terms of denying you your enjoyment of basketball. Here's a quote from Rand we're going to leave off with. She says, 443, page 443 of the letters book, she says, quote, nobody should be compelled to join a union, nor to bargain with a union, nor to remain at work if his union calls a strike, end quote. And the context for that was that they were calling for the government to force them to work through a strike, which some people might have wanted the NBA to do, but clearly that shouldn't have happened. So unions cause problems, but they seem to have reached a deal. The deal's probably going to make basketball a little less exciting because they're trying to level the playing field.
Right.
Who knows? So that's all the time we have today. Thanks, everyone, for joining and hanging around and giving us your content in the chat room there. If you want to keep up with us during the week, if you want to chime on the Islam versus Islam, go to don'tletitgo.com. Follow me at Amy Peikoff at Twitter and also Ayn Rand Bot. Have a good evening, everyone. Good night.
Take care.